Isaiah, I believe, chapter 21.
21, 22, and 23, we're still looking at the judgment of the nations. Move through 9, I believe 10, including Jerusalem. And in chapter 24, all of a sudden, Isaiah's vision now begins to broaden to the earth. Chapter 24, 16 times. I'll mention that again. We have the word dealing with the earth. So he begins with looking at the surrounding nations around Judah in Israel, prophesying about a historic event with involved the Assyrians, the Ethiopians, and so forth. And at times there is that light shining forth from the very last days, as the Assyrians are a type of the Antichrist and so forth. And as we get to 24, very much more clearly focusing in on what will be happening in the last days. So we'll move through the next three chapters rather quickly. As we begin chapter 21, it says, "The burden of the desert of the sea." And we'll see as we move in, speaking of Babylon, and spiritually Babylon is always a desert wasteland. "As the whirlwind in the south passes through, so it cometh from the desert, from the terrible land. A grievous vision is declared unto me. The treacherous dealer dealeth treacherously, and the spoiler spoileth. Go up, O Elam," the area of Persia, "besiege, O Media. All the sighing thereof have I made to cease." Now, scholars, again, as we go through this, we have a movement historically. It's not real interesting. Sennacherib, 702, he besieged Babylon and overcame it. Then you have mention here of Elam, the Persians, maybe still tribal at that time, pointing to Assyria. Some scholars feel it's speaking of the Medes and the Persians when they overthrew Babylon in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. Certainly, it looks forward at times all the way down to the end. So that's the thing that we want to see. There's a near and a far. And for us, whether it's Sennacherib or Nebuchadnezzar, is not going to make much difference to us in the next week or the next month. But the far picture, the one that's still ahead of us, there are things that we want to see and glean from those things as we move. So if it's the Medes and the Persians, it's still 200 years ahead of Isaiah as he prophesies. "Therefore are my loins filled with pain. Pangs have taken hold upon me as the pangs of a woman that travaileth." And this woman in travail is something that we hear involved with the last days often. Jesus talked about wars, rumors of wars, kingdom against kingdom, nation against nation, famine, earthquake, pestilence. These are the beginning of sorrows, birth pains, a woman in travail. Here Isaiah said that the vision itself was so horrendous that it caused him pain. His physical makeup couldn't stand what he was seeing. We see that with Daniel at times. We see it with the prophets at times. Any of them who draw close to the throne of God or see visions of angels fall down as dead men. So Isaiah now saying that it had an effect on his physical body. He was thrown into pain like a woman in travail. "I was bowed down at the hearing of it. I was dismayed at the seeing of it. My heart panted. Fearfulness frightened me. The night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear unto me. Prepare the table, watch in the watchtower. Eat, drink, arise, O ye princes, anoint the shield." The shields were made of leather. They would oil them so they wouldn't crack. "For thus hath the Lord said unto me, Go, set a watchman, and let him declare what he seeth. And he saw a chariot with a couple of horsemen, a chariot with asses, a chariot of camels. And he hearkened diligently with much heed, and he cried, A lion," which points to Babylon, "My Lord, I stand continually upon the watchtower in the daytime, and I am set in my place the whole night. And behold, here cometh a chariot of men with a couple of horsemen. And he answered, Fallen. Babylon is fallen, fallen." Now the repetition of that reminds us certainly of the book of Revelation, where it is said that great city Babylon is fallen, is fallen. "And all the graven images of her gods hath he broken unto the ground. O my threshing, and the grain of my floor, that which I have heard of the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, have I declared unto you. So again, and I'm personally convinced that as Isaiah sees this, he not only sees something historically, but when we're hearing Babylon, Babylon is fallen. We're hearing about the threshing floor. John the Baptist spoke of the threshing floor. He has gathered his grain in the garner, and he shall burn the chaff with unquenchable weed and so forth. That we're still, that Isaiah is seeing not only the Medes and the Persians, not only Sennacherib, not only a tremendous amount of carnage in his own day, but he's seeing something down to the end of the age. And as we look at the book of Revelation, we see at times with a population now of over 5 billion, a billion slain at a time, a billion and a quarter slain in the first slaughter, Revelation chapter 6. Then another time, the second fourth, which is over a billion, all of a sudden gone in an hour. Some of the things that take place in the book of Revelation are beyond our comprehension. That would be like all of the United States, Canada, and Europe disappearing at one time. No human being left alive. We can't comprehend that. We can't comprehend the things that will be coming on the earth. So I think as Isaiah sees some of these things down into the future, his frame can't even stand what he's actually seeing. Now, the burden of Duma, which is Edom. He called to me out of Seir. We moved to another country. Watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night? And the watchman said, the morning cometh, and also the night. If you will inquire, inquire ye. Return and come. I'm not going to try to interpret all this to you. Believe me. The burden upon Arabia in the forest. In Arabia shall ye lodge, O ye traveling companies of Dedanim. Now, Dedam, Sheba and Dedam, we hear that in Ezekiel. The Dedamites, or the Dedamin, and the Sheba, they were the two tribes that settled the area of what Saudi Arabia is today. Sheba and Dedan, two tribal families. We hear that spoken of in the book of Ezekiel. And it's interesting, as we look at the last days, it seems as though Saudi Arabia, as Israel is invaded by Russia, really doesn't get involved. They stand back and they say, why are you coming to take a spoil? They stand back watching. And it seems that Persia is part of the movement there. Today, Israel, in many ways, it seems, trusting Iran more than the Saudis. In fact, most people don't know that during the war between Iran and Iraq, we thought after the Shah of Iran was put out that it would be short-lived because the Iranians would be running out of the United States replacement parts for their F-16s and some of the jets that we had sold them, and yet the Iranians flew those jets all through the confrontation, and it's because behind the scenes they were taking off from Iran as the jets were breaking down, flying them to Israel, and the Israelis were repairing the Iranian jets because the Israelis felt like they owed a debt to Iran for oil they had received when they were in a jam. So behind the scenes, Israel was helping them. And hopefully Israel, I know the people in the Israeli government, and I just had heard Chuck talk about it again, have gotten hold of lots of his tapes on prophecy. In fact, if you read May God Cancels, it mentions in there one of the reasons that Israel was prompted to go into Lebanon, because they had listened to Chuck Smith in the Knesset, Chuck Smith's latest set, Israel and Prophecy. And it was part of what helped made up their mind to go in. And hopefully they're listening to some of the more recent tapes and realizing we better be better friends with the Saudi Arabians than with the Iranians, and getting the picture. In fact, when we're over there and traveling down the Jordan Valley and we're up at Belvoir Castle, our guide will say to us sometimes as we look at the Jarmuk Valley, he'll say, now that's probably one of the valleys that the Soviets will use when they invade Israel. You know, and we say, you know about that? You know, and they'll say, well, yeah, we know about that, you know. So that's, I guarantee you, a hot valley if they're expecting something to happen there. But as you read of Dedan and Sheba in the Bible, the areas of Saudi Arabia, the inhabitants of the land of Tema brought water to him that was thirsty. They prevented with their bread him that fled. They helped For they fled from the swords and from the drawn sword, again, looking at Assyria, from the bent bow and from the grievous war. For thus hath the Lord said unto me, within a year, according to the years of a hireling, all the glory of Kedar shall fail. So these tribal nations, which were not that important in his day, but he says within a year they're going to be wiped out. And again, it meant to Isaiah's contemporaries that they could check out his prophecies and see if he was telling the truth. I mean, if somebody told you within a year from tonight, Libya will have disappeared, or within a year from tonight, Iran and Iraq will have signed a treaty and become one nation again. And then you figure, well, we got 1 year before we stone Pastor Joe, you know. And so one of the amazing things as we travel through these chapters is Isaiah saying within a year, within 2 years, within 3 years, again, a witness to his contemporaries that his whole message is from God. And the residue of the number of the archers and the mighty men of the children of Kedar shall be diminished, for the Lord, the God of Israel, has spoken it. He turns to Jerusalem, the burden of the valley of vision. Chapter 1, verse 1 speaks of the vision that Isaiah is having. So he's seeing these things, these prophecies. What aileth thee now that thou art wholly gone up to the housetops? Thou art full of stirs, a tumultuous city, a joyous city. Thy slain men are not slain with the sword, nor dead in battle. All thy rulers are fled together. They are bound by the archers. All that are found in thee are bound together, which have fled from far. Therefore, said I, look away from me. I will weep bitterly. Labor not to comfort me, because of the spoiling of the daughter of my people. For it is a day of trouble, and of treading down, and of perplexity by the Lord God of hosts in the valley of vision, breaking down the walls and of the crying of the mount to the mountains. Now, again, at this particular time, remember, the Assyrian army would surround Jerusalem, but 185,000 Assyrians would be slain in one night. So again, as Isaiah is saying, by the Spirit of the Lord, don't try to comfort me because of the situation, probably looking down again further into the future, because it was a tremendous victory on the part of the Lord in 2 Kings 19 in this historic setting. And Elam bare the quiver with chariots of men and horsemen, and Kir uncovered the shield. It shall come to pass that thy choicest valley shall be full of chariots. Now this is when they're surrounded. And the horsemen shall set themselves in array at the gate. And he discovered the covering of Judah. Thou didst look in that day to the armor of the house of the forest. Evidently, they looked to one of Solomon's palaces. Hezekiah, we know, tried to prepare. He didn't know what to do. He had been warned by Isaiah not to try to make an alliance with Egypt and so forth to stand against the Assyrians. Isaiah had been telling Hezekiah, trust in the Lord, he will deliver you. And yet as the armies of Sennacherib, of the Assyrians, surrounded Jerusalem, Hezekiah did try to prepare, evidently taking some of the arms out of one of Solomon's palaces, the house of the forest. Ye have seen also the breaches of the city of David, that they are many. Big parts of the walls were broken down. And you gathered together the waters of the lower pool. Now this when Hezekiah dug his tunnel, 1,777 feet through solid rock. Hezekiah dug from the Gihon spring down to the pool of Siloam. And when you go over there today, if you're interested, we're going in March of 91, you can take your flashlight and go down into Hezekiah's tunnel and walk through there, something I've never personally delighted to do. The ceiling on the tunnel gets lower and lower, and you're in water, and sometimes the water gets higher and higher. There's not much room between your head and the ceiling, and you have a flashlight, and the water's real cold, and I'm not sure how clean it is. But if you want, you can go down the Gihon Springs, where Solomon was anointed, and you can go down into that spring, and then you can walk all the way through this tunnel, hand-carved. Hezekiah started a team on each end, and 1,777 feet, they hacked away with hammers and chisels and met in some miraculous way in the middle, and then they covered up the Gihon spring. See, if in any city in those days, if you were besieged and you were surrounded, it would be nothing for that army to wait 5 years. Nebuchadnezzar besieged Tyre for 13 years. And if they could find your water supply for the city and cut it off, you were done. Then famine set in and disease, and often then there was people turned to cannibalism and so forth. And it happened often in Jerusalem. So Hezekiah dug this tunnel down to the from the Gihon Spring down to the pool of Siloam, and then covered up the Gihon Spring so that you really couldn't see the source of water from outside, and the water, instead of just flowing there, would flow down to the pool of Siloam, be within the city, so they could get at it. And here, talking of that, Hezekiah's tunnel flowing down to the lower pool. And ye have numbered the houses of Jerusalem, and the houses have ye broken down to fortify the wall. And again, one of the most remarkable things as we travel through the city of Jerusalem today is they found the wall that Hezekiah built. And it's huge. It's about 13 or 14 foot wide. And next to the wall, the excavations are laid open, and they have the scriptures written real big there. You can see where the houses have been broken down, and they've taken the stones that the houses were made of to build up the wall. And you can actually stand there and read this verse and see where Hezekiah broke down some of the people's homes to fill up the breaches in the walls. It's remarkable. Broken down the walls. You have also made between the two walls for the water of the old pool, but you have not looked unto the maker thereof, neither had respect unto him that fashioned it long ago. So man making all his preparations to deal with some of the tremendous things that are coming on him in the future, as man does today, and yet never looking to the God who formed it all. I think the sad state that our nation is in. And in that day did the Lord God of hosts call to weeping and to mourning and to baldness and to girding with sackcloth. And behold, joy and gladness, slaying of oxen, killing of sheep, eating of flesh, drinking wine. Let us eat, drink, and you can put be merry there. For tomorrow we die. And, you know, here the Lord was calling for repentance in the city. He was going to destroy the Assyrians. And they, you know, they didn't know what they could do. And they developed this attitude inside the city as they looked, you know, people without a vision, cast off restraint. And as they said to themselves, what the heck? What's the use? You know, let's party. I mean, again, it is remarkable to me to think sometimes of the world that we live in, and some of the friends that I used to hang around with and spend all my time with who are still doing the same things that we were doing 20 years ago. Their marriages haven't lasted. They're still hanging out in the same bars, fist fighting, taking the same drugs, and their brains look like, you know, fried egg, you know. And meantime, the inhabited earth, as we know it today, is going down the tubes, and there's about to be a tremendous change. Let us eat, drink, for tomorrow we die. The superpowers are preparing for war. It's interesting. Since Glasnost began, the Soviets have had a 25% increase in military spending. I have some of the paperwork on my desk. You know, we're all looking at them like we can trust the Russians now, but they've been preparing more laboriously than ever. And I have a speech made by Gorbachev in 1987 to the Politburo. It was recorded by the man who used to be the head of the Combined Armed Forces Intelligence during World War II, got record of it, and Gorbachev says to the Politburo, and maybe I'll print them up, put them up where people can see them, he said, the changes that you see with Glasnost and Perestroika in the next few years, that shouldn't be changes that alarm you. They're mostly for outward consumption. The inward policy of the Soviet Union will not change. We have three goals involving the Americans. First is we want them to withdraw conventional forces from Europe. Our second goal is we want them to withdraw nuclear arms from Europe. And our third goal is we want them to stop with the Strategic Defense Initiative. And he's quoted in 1987 saying this to the Politburo. So, meantime, the whole world, I saw one of these, it was a movie star from some soap opera on a talk show, and he said, I saw Gorbachev and President Bush together, and it made me cry. Like, peace is really here, man. Like, we're working it all out, man. Like, it's all working out. And, you know, I understand the sentiment, but, man, what a fog people are in. It was revealed in my ears by the Lord of hosts, surely this iniquity shall not be purged from you till you die, saith the Lord God of hosts. Thus saith the Lord God of hosts, go, get thee into to the treasurer, even unto Shebna, which is over the house. And say, evidently, Shebna, one of Hezekiah's treasurers, who had been sent to talk back and forth with one of Sennacherib's generals. And we don't get all the details, but from here we get the impression that Shebna, behind the scenes, was planning for his own benefit more than anything. He says, what hast thou here? And whom hast thou here? You know, the Lord knows what Shebna was doing. That's the interesting thing. And thou hast hewed thee a sepulchre here, as he that heweth him out a sepulchre on high, and that graveth a habitation for himself in the rock. So meantime, Shebna, planning to make a deal with the Assyrians behind the scenes, evidently behind Hezekiah's back, carving himself a huge sepulchre there, probably in the valley of Kidron, planning on, being an icon in the minds of Judah in the future. The Lord says, you're carving out a big stone tomb here. You think you're going to make a mark. Huh? You think nobody knows what you're doing? Behold, the Lord will carry thee away with a mighty captivity and will surely cover thee. The Lord will bury you in a foreign land. He will surely violently turn and toss thee like a ball into a large country. The picture is of somebody, you know, you ever see that guy doing the advertisement, what's the Bell Yellow Pages good for anyway, and he crumbles it up and goes, pew, 2 points. That's the picture here. It's of the Lord crumpling up Shebna like a ball in his hand and pew, into a foreign country. There shalt thou die, there the chariots of thy glory shall be the shame of thy Lord's house. And I will drive thee from thy station, and from the state shall he pull thee down. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah. So here's another man, an honorable man. And again, we're going to look at near and far. Shebna is a type of the Antichrist. Eliakim, we're going to see very clearly, a type of Jesus Christ. Shebna, the one who, dealing politically and a power broker behind the scenes, trying to set himself up as something that he wasn't. Meantime, the Lord aware all the time. And Eliakim, the man behind the scenes, whom God would establish. I will clothe him with thy robe and strengthen him with thy girdle. I will commit thy government unto his hand, and he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. And the key of the house of David will I lay upon his shoulder. Now you remember Revelation, the letter of the church of Philadelphia. We hear these things. Revelation chapter 1:18, Revelation chapter 3, verse 7. He shall open and none shall shut. He shall shut, and none shall open. And I will fasten him as a goad or a nail in a sure place, and he shall be for a glorious throne to his father's house. And notice verse 24, they shall hang upon him all the glory of his father's house. So looking forward to Christ, a fixed goad, they would take an oak peg or a cedar peg, some wood that was hard, drive it into a prominent place in the wall or in a beam, and then the important things in the master's house would often be hung upon that. And it's saying here, this Eliakim, the one who is coming, the key of David will be placed in his hand, and we're told that speaking about Jesus in Revelation, that he shall open and no man shall shut, he shall shut and no man shall open, and it says he's going to be like a fixed peg, and all the goods of his father's house shall hang upon him, the glory of his father's house shall hang upon him. And again, it's hard for us as we just read through this because there's a historical background, and Isaiah evidently is familiar with Sheba and Eliakim, and yet as God ministers these things to him, he is seeing some vision. He is seeing something, and evidently down into the future again. The offspring and the issue of all vessels of small in quantity, from the vessels of cups even to the vessels of flagons, all the vessels of his father's house were vessels. In that day, saith the Lord of hosts, shall the nail that is fastened in a sure place be removed, be cut down. Now we fall back to this dark scene. And the burden that was upon it shall be cut off, for the Lord has spoken it. The burden of Tyre, and you're probably tired of these judgment of the nations. This is the last nation here now. And again, Tyre, besieged by Sennacherib for a number of years, taking the mainland, but Tyre being an island off the coast. Then after that, Nebuchadnezzar, when Babylon was in power, besieging Tyre for 13 years, not being able to get to it. And then finally, Alexander the Great, and I forget, was within a year, came there, realized he couldn't deal with it. It was an island. The Phoenicians were always great sailors. So he built a causeway out of rock, took his soldiers and just started throwing the rocks into the Mediterranean and just built a huge bridge out to the island and walked out and took it. And for years, archaeologists thought it was an isthmus. They thought it was a jut out of the land until they started digging down and realized all these rocks were brought in and placed here by Alexander the Great. So the burden of Tyre. How will ye ships of Tarshish? For it is laid waste, so that there is no house, no entering in. From the land of Chittim it is revealed to them. And the Phoenicians were the center of world trade, sailing across the Mediterranean in that part of the world. Tarshish, probably the southern part of Spain. Perhaps Britain, we're not sure. Be still, ye inhabitants of the isle, to whom the merchants of Zidon that pass over the sea have replenished. And by great waters the seed of Sihor, the harvest of the river down to Egypt, is her revenue. And she is the mart of the nations, the Kmart of the nations. Be thou ashamed, O Zidon, for the sea has spoken, even the strength of the sea, saying, I travail not, nor bring forth children, neither do I nourish up young men, nor bring up virgins. As at the report concerning Egypt, so shall they be sorely pained at the report of Tyre. Now, everything being shaken in the Mediterranean area, you think that you had bad news about Egypt? Wait till you hear what's going to happen to Tyre. Pass ye over to Tarshish. Howl, ye inhabitants of the isle. Is this your joyous city, whose antiquity is of ancient days? Her own feet shall carry her afar off to Sergon, to flee. Who hath taken this counsel against Tyre, the crowning city? Now, who else could do that? Whose merchants are princes, whose traffickers are the honorable men of the earth, who's the one who can bring down the whole economic and political system of the known world? The Lord of hosts has purposed it, to stain the pride of all glory, and to bring into contempt all the honorable of the earth. Pass through thy land as a river, O daughter of Tarshish, there is no more strength. He stretched out his hand over the sea, he shook the kingdoms. The Lord hath given the commandment against the merchant city to destroy the strongholds thereof. And he said, thou shalt no more rejoice, thou oppressed virgin, daughter of Zidon. Arise, pass over to Chittim, there also shalt thou not rest. Behold, the land of the Chaldeans, this people was not till the Assyrians founded it, for them that dwell in the wilderness. Now, the idea is that Babylon, the Chaldeans, really started to take on form, and the Assyrians founded it. They set up the towers thereof, they raised up the palaces thereof, and he brought it to ruin. Howl, ye ships of Tarshish, for your strength is laid waste. And it shall come to pass in that day that Tyre shall be forgotten. 70 years, according to the days of one king, after the end of 70 years shall Tyre sing as a harlot. So from about 700 B.C. to 630, all the shipping, and this is before Alexander the Great, the merchandise of Tyre was by and large stopped by the Assyrians. And at the end of 70 years, there was a break again, and Tyre started to flourish again for a while. And it compares Tyre then to the song of a harlot. In the ancient marketplace, often a prostitute would sit in a place and sing a song to lure men into her business. I don't know what the song was. Tyre shall sing as a harlot. Take a harp, go about the city, thou harlot that has been forgotten. Make sweet melody, sing many songs that thou mayest be remembered. And often, as we hear about a harlot, the great harlot in Revelation, committing fornication with the kings of the earth, the system of trade and political manipulation and economic power is compared to spiritual fornication. And it shall come to pass after the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre, and she shall turn to her hire, and shall commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth. And her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness to the Lord, and it shall not be treasured nor laid up, for her merchandise shall be for them that dwell before the Lord to eat sufficiently, and for durable clothing. Now, as we pass through, we come to chapter 24. And now the whole vision of Isaiah begins to broaden in a tremendous way. And there's a movement from 24 through 27 here as we go. Behold, the Lord maketh the earth empty, comparing it to a vessel being poured out. And again, that phrase, the earth, now 16 times in this chapter. So we've certainly broadened out from the surrounding nations to all nations. And he maketh it waste, and he turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. So we're not sure whether it's saying, when it says he turneth it upside down, whether we're talking about seismic activity where big major parts of world plates are going to be flipped over. We know that Jesus talked about the signs on the earth, the tidal waves, men's hearts failing them for fear, looking at the things that are coming on the earth. The earthquake that we just saw in San Francisco, really nothing compared to some of the things they're expecting. There was recorded in the 1800s in the Midwest, an earthquake that cracked windows in New York and Philadelphia and rung the Liberty Bell. It was in the Mississippi Valley or the Missouri Valley, and it was in the middle of a plate. It wasn't anywhere near a fault, and so powerful, we only have record of some of the aftershocks and so forth and what took place, but we've seen nothing. And as we come into the book of Revelation and look at the very last days, there seems to be four or five major quakes that are taking place. One in Ezekiel 39 after the Russian invasion. The whole land shakes, the fish of the sea, the fowl of the air, and every wall and every house fall in the area of Jerusalem at that time, at the beginning, coming into the Daniel 70th week. And then as we get into the tribulation, other earthquakes. And what God's doing really, and we're going to see it here, he's cleaning house. In the beginning, as we look at the earth and the Garden of Eden, with the ecosystem and everything that God had set up, a remarkable system, very hard for us to understand. There was the vapor canopy, and it filtered out certain infrared and ultraviolet lights, and evidently the longevity of man. Adam, after he fell, after the sin, lived to be 900 years old, and the genetic structure of man, a pretty remarkable thing. And evidently, if he hadn't sinned, he'd have just, everybody would got to be about 30 years old and leveled off. Isn't that a great idea? Everybody here is over 30. Just get to around 30 years old and just kind of level off there, you know, in a remarkable way. Some of the ferns that we find fossil records of, you know, 30, 40 foot ferns, must have been a beautiful garden. And God is revamping during the last 7 years the earth in many ways, preparing for the millennium when there'll be tremendous changes in the earth again. And those of you who don't believe in the millennium, it's really going to be a treat for you. Maybe speaking of an axis flip here, the Lord turning the earth upside down. Some scientists feel in the past there was a polar axis flip. There's some indication, Revelation chapter 11, that we're going to be back to a 360-day year, literal, which is remarkable because the prophecies in Daniel chapter 9 dealt with 70 times 7, 360-day years. And it seems like that last seven-year period set aside to be filled in the earth and upon Israel is a 360-day year, seven-year period. So there may be some cataclysmic thing coming into it. The invasion of the Soviet Union in the Mideast, the tremendous earthquake in the earth at that point in time, wobbles. We're in a wobble every 7 to 11 years now again. You've all had tops when you were a kid. Most of you are that old. And spin the top and it goes for a while pretty good, and then all of a sudden it starts to go crazy. Sometimes they even flip over. Sometimes they lay down on their side and then stand back up again. Well, the earth goes into a wobble. The Lord, long time ago, at least 6,000 years ago, took the earth and went, pew, or put a string on it, I'm not sure, and went and started it spinning. And it's slowing down, and it wobbles now every 7 to 11 years. But remarkable things happening in the earth. It shall be as with the people, so with the priest. As with the servant, so with the master. As with the maid, so with the mistress. As with the buyer, so with the seller. As with the lender, so with, you know, this sounds like our day. It sounds like it's happening to us.
talking about mistresses and borrowers and sellers and lenders and those that take interest. That sounds like our society. So the giver, what it's saying is no strata of society is going to escape this because it's going to be global. Everybody's going to have to face it, no matter whether you just stored 6,000 pounds of wheat and brought yourself, 25, 30-odd sixes and a mountain in Wyoming and you cut down all the trees so you can shoot people as they're rushing your house to get food and water. Nobody escapes this. And believe me, there are some scholars in the church that hold a post-tribulation view on the rapture that have bought themselves homes in the wildernesses and stored food. Ridiculous. The land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled, for the Lord hath spoken this word. The earth shall mourn and fadeth away. The world languisheth and fadeth away. The haughty people of the earth are languishing. The earth is defiled thereof because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant. So not the Abrahamic covenant or the Mosaic covenant, but the everlasting covenant, the covenant that God made and even in the beginning in Eden between him and man of obedience to God and respect for God. They've broken the everlasting covenant. In the beginning, God looked at all his creation. He said, it is good. It is very good. Remarkable to follow him through that series. And then here, they've destroyed the earth. They've polluted it. They've ruined it. It says, therefore hath the curse devoured the earth. They that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. Now, is that talking of nuclear war? I don't know. Possibly. We know in Matthew 24 it said if Christ were not to return when he did, that there would be no flesh left alive. We know the earth is going to come to that point, almost to where humankind is annihilated. The new wine mourneth, and the vine languisheth. All the merry-hearted do sigh. The mirth of the tabrets ceases, and the noise of them that rejoice endeth the joy, and the harp ceases. They shall not drink wine with a song. Strong drink shall be bitter to them that drink it. The city of confusion is broken down, and every house is shut up, and no man comes in. So the state of the world, no more joy, no more partying. Again, interesting, and I think it fits so well in our society. Party, which used to be a noun in our language, has become a verb. And it's not a thing anymore. It's an action. And the party's going to end is basically what it's saying. It's going to be over. It's going to come like a snare, Jesus says, upon those who dwell on the face of the earth. 11 says, there is a crying for wine in the streets. All joy is darkened. The mirth of the land is gone. In the city is left desolation, and the gate is smitten with destruction. When thus it shall be in the midst of the land among the people, there shall be as the shaking of an olive tree and as the gleaning of grapes when the vintage is done. They shall lift up their voice. They shall sing for the majesty of the Lord. They shall cry aloud from the sea. Now it's speaking of when this day comes, when the earth is just about obliterated, when the human race is almost annihilated. We know in that day. And as we get to Isaiah 63, we get a remarkable picture of the Lord coming through the sky from Bozrah, from the area of Edom, from the east to the west, as Matthew said, shining like the light, coming from the east to the west, touching down on the Mount of Olives, destroying the Antichrist and the armies that have gathered there around Jerusalem. And it says, in that day, those who believe, the remnant, those that are scattered around the nations that are still alive, begin to cry for joy. Begin to realize that it's all over. The greatest hell that living human beings have ever seen. It says, when it shall be in the midst of the land and so forth, when it's like an olive tree with just a few olives left, and like when the gleaning of grapes is done, there's just a few grapes left on the vine. They shall lift up their voice and sing for the majesty of the Lord. They shall cry aloud from the sea. Wherefore glorify ye the Lord in the fires, even the name of the Lord of Israel in the isles of the sea, or the valleys in the isles. We're not sure exactly what Isaiah is seeing here. From the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs, even glory to the righteous. But I said, my leanness, woe unto me. The treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously, yea, the treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Now, Isaiah is saying, I've seen this tremendous vision, and from the ends of the earth we've seen there's a day coming when people will rejoice, when there will be righteousness and justice in the earth. But he says, in the middle of it all, woe, my leanness. He's still in this historical background. He's still trapped in time and space, as it were. And still looking at the horror that will accompany this time. Fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee, O inhabitant of the earth. And again, Jesus said that our hearts should not be overcharged with drunkenness and intoxication with the things of this world, because as a snare it shall overtake them that dwell on the face of the earth. Here it talks about those that fall into the pit that was dug to trap animals. If they get out, the snare will come upon them. And it shall come to pass that he who fleeth from the noise of the fear shall fall into the pit, and he that cometh up out of the midst of the pit shall be taken in the snare. For the windows from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth do shake. Not a day that I want to be around. And only the Lord understands what the foundations of the earth are. You know, you study just our solar system, there's some remarkable things. Different planets rotating in different directions. You know, they talk about the Big Bang, but if our origin was from the Big Bang, all of the planets would be rotating in the same direction, the moons would be going in the same direction, and the more we learn about just our solar system, we find out there's different planets spinning in different directions, different moons rotating in different directions, different moon around the planets, and then different moons rotating within themselves in different directions. Not so easy to buy anymore. And in fact, again, in the last 20 years, we've discovered that the Earth is shrinking at something like 5 foot a second, which is not important to the sun. It's so big, but that seems like a lot to you. Only if we could lose weight that way, right? We could sell our tapes and books. But the sun losing about 5 foot a second, and scientists realize now at that rate, 100,000 years ago, the earth would have been too hot to support life, and 1 million years ago, the surface of the sun would have been touching the surface of the earth, and of course, all of our brilliant men say, well, 40 billion years ago, we climbed out of a bunch of slime, you know, and developed an eyeball, and somebody better get the story straight. The foundations of the earth will be shaken. The earth is utterly broken down. The earth is clean dissolved. The earth is moved exceedingly. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard. You know, I mean, God's telling the inhabitants of the earth, you know, your party's over, you know. No more drinking for you. Now it's the earth's turn to reel to and fro like a drunken man. That's what you want. That's what you're going to get. And shall be removed like a cottage, like a little shack that's built in the wind. And the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise again. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and notice, the kings of the earth upon the earth. So, interesting. In that day, and we read in Revelation chapter 16, when the last vial is poured out, it's poured out upon the air. That's interesting, because we hear of the prince of the power of the air. And it says, in that day, when God finally consummates his judgment in the earth, he's going to punish the host of the high ones from on high. Satan, the angels, bound in the abyss for 1,000 years during his reign. The high ones will be punished. And we're taught clearly that our warfare is not against flesh and blood. And sometimes, you know, that's hard to remember, because I get in a situation sometime when somebody irks me so much that I think,
that I put a whole Bronson movie together in my mind. You know, I get this guy in an alley, I'll hit him here, hit him there, and four or five hits, I'll have this, I know exactly what I'm doing, you know. And the Lord, you know, has to say, no, you're Pastor Joe, you're not supposed to beat people up. And I think, Lord, I'll do it at night, nobody will see me. And besides, if I lie, everybody will believe me, Lord, you know. You know, and sometimes, you know, in ourselves, we forget that, you know, behind it all, our warfare is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and so forth, spiritual forces in high places and wickedness. And again, if you're here this evening and you can't buy that, you know, you don't, you've got to understand, look at Yale, look at Duke, look at Harvard, look at the big money that's being allocated for parapsychology and paraphysics and the research into the abnormal. And it's okay for them to turn up poltergeists, and it's okay for them to get somebody that can read cards with their mind, and it's okay for them to get all their paranormal people. But for you to believe in principalities and powers, you must be an idiot. You see, if they can't register it or take a picture, they don't buy it. They understand, again, radio waves. There's voices that are traveling right through this room right now, right through our heads, right through our bodies. And they understand transmitters and receivers. So they say, okay, these are radio waves. We understand that. And then there are audiovisual waves that are traveling right through here right now, right through our minds, right through our bodies, right through this mall. And they understand that because that comes out on a television screen. We built the transmitter. We built the receiver. We understand that there's voices and pictures and images passing right through the air. We don't see them. We understand microwaves because they cook meat from the inside out, and we understand how that works and try to make a roast in one of those, you know. And we understand radar and sonar and all this stuff, but don't tell me that there are other voices and images out there that we haven't registered, transmitted, or received. But it seems like we're spending an awful lot of money now to admit, you know, Time Life books. Ooh, you see this every night, you know, like, oh, strange visitors, this and that, you know, Stonehenge, look at, you know. I mean, you people that went up to the New Age Festival in New York, you know there's some pretty paranormal people walking around these days. Well, there's going to come a day, the Lord says, when he punishes the host of the high ones from on high, those spiritual principalities and powers that are working behind the scenes, bringing destruction in the earth. And the kings of the earth, who they have influence over, also will be judged, and they shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit. Remember the demons that went that were the devil Ham in the Gospels there? Don't send us into the pit or the abyss. They shall be gathered in the pit and shall be shut up in the prison, and after many days they shall be visited. Then the moon shall be confounded, and the sun shall be ashamed, when the Lord of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem and before his ancients gloriously. I think we should read that once more. You know, it says the moon shall not give her light, and the sun shall not give her light, and moon shall be turned to blood. But it seems like it's saying something a little different here. The beauty of the glory of the terrestrial body is ashamed at the beauty and majesty of Christ as he comes. Then the moon shall be confounded. The sun will be ashamed in all of its brilliance and strength. When the Lord of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem and before his ancients gloriously. We may be included in there somewhere, those ancients, by the way. It's Jesus told us that many are going to come from the east and west and sit down at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and how I'm looking forward to that. So, remarkable. O Lord, thou art my God, I will exalt thee. Now, what else could Isaiah say after seeing this scene? I will praise thy name, for thou hast done awesome. When it says wonderful, it's fearful, it's awe-inspiring there. Things. Thy counsels of old are faithful and true. Everything you've ever said will come to pass. For thou hast made of a city a heap, and of a fortified city a ruin. And you've made of a palace of strangers to be no city, it shall never be built. Therefore shall the strong people glorify thee, the city of the terrible nations shall fear thee, all of the earth. For thou hast been a strength to the poor, and a strength to the needy in his distress. And he's been a strength to us in our distress. Jesus said, remember, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. In our needy state, how many times since the first time has he been a fortress and a strength to us? And he always takes up the place of those who are poor and needy. He's a refuge from the storm, a shadow from the heat. And when the blast of the terrible ones is as a storm against the wall, he's there to protect. Thou shalt bring down the noise of the strangers as the heat of a dry place, even the heat with the shadow of a cloud. The branch of the terrible ones shall be brought low. And in this mountain shall the Lord of hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things. Sounds good. A feast of wines on the lees. Jesus said, we shall no more drink of this cup till we drink it together in my Father's kingdom. The book of Joel says in that day that the hills themselves shall melt, turn to mud, because the grapes on the vine shall be so tremendous that the sower is going to overtake the reaper, that the man who goes out to reap the harvest, there's going to be so much, it's going to take so long to try to gather it in, the guy's going to be coming up behind him saying, hey, I got to plant next year's crop, finish your job, will you? And actually the mountains of Carmel, or there's great grape juice today, comes from Carmel, but Carmel hasn't seen anything yet. Carmel, the vineyard of God. I think that's prophetic in itself. Carmel hasn't seen a grape yet. A great feast of fatted things, of the wines on lees, on their lees, of fat things full of marrow, of wines on the lees, well refined. And he will destroy in this mountain the face of the covering cast over all people, and the veil that is spread over all nations. Now, possibly Isaiah pointing to the veil that was placed over a dead body, but certainly the veil that's on the eyes of humanity will be removed. Notice, he will swallow up death in victory. Sound familiar? 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And the Lord God will wipe away tears from off all faces. No faces rejected. No tears that are not important enough for the touch of the Master's hand. Nobody excluded. Everybody who has a tear gets to feel the hand of Jesus Christ on their face. And the rebuke of his people shall he take away from off all the earth. The reason why? Simple. For the Lord has spoken it. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. So I think maybe looking at the marriage supper of the Lamb here, too often I think we think of the marriage supper of the Lamb in the heavenly scene, and if that's where it is, fine with me. Wherever the reception is going to be, that's great. But we're not the guests at the feast, we're the bride. And it seems to me that the marriage supper of the Lamb will take place in Jerusalem. The bride is seen for who she is. God's people through the ages gathered to this great feast that the Lord sets the table. You know it's going to be something. A great party. Death is swallowed up in victory. A tremendous consciousness in everybody present. And it shall be said in that day, lo, this is our God. We have waited for him. And he will save us. This is the Lord. We have waited for him. We will be glad and rejoice in his salvation. So certainly the cry of Israel on that day. You and I will say it too. When the trumpet blows, twinkling of an eye,
we'll look up and see his face and we'll say, this is the Lord, and man, I've been waiting for him. For in this mountain shall the hand of the Lord rest, and Moab shall be trodden down under him, even as straw is trodden down for the dunghill. He shall spread forth his hands in the midst of them, as he that swimmeth spreadeth forth his hands to swim. Now I think we're looking again to Isaiah 63. Moab trodden down, the Lord coming through like somebody who trods, treading down the part of the straw that couldn't be used to put in the dunghill, and as one that's swimming through waters, the Lord coming through the enemy and masses of humanity. What a graphic picture. And he shall bring down their pride together with the spoils of their hands, and the fortress of the high fort of thy walls shall he bring down, lay low, and bring to the ground, even to the dust. In three more verses, because it goes together, in that day. Now, this is the day of the verse 9. Look back to chapter 25. It shall be in that day. Now, look, here's that day again. There were no chapter breaks, is the idea in the Hebrew. In that day shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. So, again, you want to learn some of the words of some of the songs you're going to be singing. There are many of them through scriptures. Here's one. It'd be good for you to know this song. Lots of people, you have to realize, millions probably in the city of Philadelphia and tens of millions around the world that call themselves Christians and never read the book of Isaiah. And when we come to the marriage supper of the Lamb, again, I don't want to see you sitting around going, duh, you know. You say, hey, we were at Pastor Joe's church. He taught us the words of this song. And you help the guy next to you jot the words down on a napkin real quick before dinner starts and say, this is what we're going to be singing. This is a song. The Lord just said, all these things are going to happen because I've spoken it, and you can bet this song is going to be sung. It says, this is the song that shall be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. Open ye the gates, that the righteous nation that keepeth the truth may enter in, and thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee. Trust ye in the Lord forever. For in the Lord Jehovah is everlasting strength. In fact, maybe one of our musicians here will take the time to write this and use this lyrics and make a song so we can practice singing it and get ready for that day. He will keep thee in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee. I think that's a great promise even for us today. Seems like there are many other things in our busy world for our minds to be stayed upon. It's a troubled world. It's full of disease and sickness and sorrow and temptation. And it seems too often that our minds, my mind, gets caught up on many things that the world has to offer us to think about. And really, that's where the struggle is in many ways. It's right here in the mind. Satan knows it. But peace promised to those who have their minds stayed upon Christ. And it isn't easy. It isn't easy. Paul said he had to bring every thought into captivity to Christ. It was constant. It went on every day. But the promise of keeping us in peace when our minds are stayed upon him. Not the peace that the world gives, Jesus says, but peace that passes understanding. Now, that's not always the consolation you're looking for. We're looking for peace that fits right within the realm of our understanding. And basically it goes like this. God, now if I was you, I'd bring the money in for the gas bill. I mean, God, if I was you, I'd heal this sickness right away. God, if I, we want peace according to understanding. But there is a promise that there's a peace that passes understanding. And how many times have we heard somebody say, I didn't think it could get any worse, and it got worse and worse, but all of a sudden I just got a peace. And I let go of the situation, and I figured, Lord, if you want it to go this way, I'm yours. And Lord, if you want to restore it, I'm yours. And we finally hear somebody say, I just gave it to the Lord. Obviously, when there were no other alternatives left, that's when we give things to the Lord. But then that peace settles in, the peace that passes understanding. We set our minds upon him, his promises. Let's stand and pray. Read ahead.